Hello, everybody. Today is November 3rd, 2024, and we are honored to have a special guest back on the show, Laith Maarouf. Laith joins us from Lebanon, and Laith is an award-winning journalist and political commentator who has been working in media since 1999. Laith is also one of the creators and producers of the volunteer TV station and news outlet Free Palestine TV, which can be found on all social media platforms and via freepalestine.video. Free Palestine TV not only has the best analysis of what is going on in Palestine of any English language news outlet, but they are one of the best sources of news from the front lines. Free Palestine TV is now putting out several videos per day from the front lines of Palestine, including the West Bank and Lebanon. So due to the fact that it is so difficult to get reliable and accurate news in the mainstream media in the West, we are very grateful to have Laith join us on the Activist News Network for a weekly news update on the Palestinian resistance to Israeli occupation and the genocidal campaign against Palestine. Laith, thank you for coming back onto the show and welcome to the Activist News Network.
Great to be with you, Chris and Raven.
Well, thank you, Laith, and we're happy to see you as always. First, we wanted to ask you about Lebanon. This past week, it was reported in Western media outlets that the Israeli occupational army has continued both its bombing campaign and its ground invasion of Lebanon, including heavy and deadly airstrikes on Lebanon's ancient city of Baalbek and other areas of eastern Lebanon. In fact, the UN warns that these heritage sites are in serious danger as a result of Israeli attacks. Laith, as someone who is living and reporting from the front lines in Lebanon, what is the latest our audience should be aware of regarding Israel's war on Lebanon from this past week?
Yes, now we're 40 days into the attempted Zionist invasion of South Lebanon, and they have failed miserably, including this morning. They had yesterday entered Al-Khayyam village right on the border, and they had to withdraw under severe, you know, fighting by the resistance. And so they withdrew from Khayyam, and then they bombarded it, and then they tried to enter this afternoon with tanks this time, and the tanks got all smoked. So their land invasion is a total failure. And we're talking about here five divisions. So, you know, each division is 30,000 Israeli fighters. Five divisions is like 150,000 troops on the border of South Lebanon, and they're not able to enter after 40 days. This is the largest number of Israeli troops ever to be, you know, deployed on the border of Lebanon in any of the previous wars. So we can see how valiant and heroic the resistance of Hezbollah and the other national patriotic groups that are fighting on his side in the south are. You mentioned both the historical sites of Baalbek and Tir or Sur in Arabic. Sur is in the south of Lebanon. It's you know, maybe half an hour from the border with Palestine. It is the ancient, one of the ancient capitals of the Phoenician people. It's one of the oldest continuously inhabited cities in the world. There's archaeological sites from all those periods, from the Phoenicians till the French occupation. And the Zionists are deliberately targeting the historical sites inside Sur. It's also the tourist swimming beach area in Lebanon that everybody loves. And it's now, you know, emptied, and the corniche, the beachfront, is destroyed. Similarly, when we're talking about Baalbek, Baalbek, the word is Baal is the godfather of the Canaanites. Baalbek is the throne seat of Baal. This is how ancient this city is. And it has some of the largest Roman and Greek archaeological sites in the world. The temples in Baalbek are bigger than the temples in Athens. And so, you know, to see the Zionists purposefully target these two cities, you can understand their intention is a historical erasure of a people and history in general that contradicts their fabricated history that they're trying to impose on the indigenous people here and on the world. Baalbek has all the villages around it has suffered immensely over the last week. Many bombardments on all those villages. You know, hundreds of people have been martyred on a daily basis. At least, 80 somewhat people are being martyred in the area around Baalbek. Now the number of civilian Lebanese people that have been martyred since the beginning of this war is reached 2,000. Of course, this doesn't count the fighters on the front. The number of Lebanese medical staff that have been martyred is over 200. Of course, we have the journalists of Al-Mayadeen that were assassinated last week. So this is overall the... On the one hand, the failures on the ground of the Zionists, and on the other, their bloodlust, crazy bombardment from the air. One last thing I would mention is that yesterday there was an Israeli special force that landed in the Batroun beach. Batroun is in the north of Lebanon, just south of Tripoli. If 10 minutes south of Tripoli is a Christian area. It's very also touristy area that has a lot of hotels, nice beaches, and a very famous museum, the Nabu Museum. And this special force kidnapped a Lebanese sea captain. Somehow the announcement was made after by the Israelis. They claimed that they were on the ground for 4 minutes and kidnapped the sea captain. They're claiming that he's one of the Hezbollah Navy officers. According to his family, his parents, his wife, his friends, he is, and also the registration, he is a civilian sea captain. He works on ships transporting live cattle and cars, automobiles. He was studying in the Naval Sciences Academy in Batroun for more, I guess, permits for different shipping that he was going to be working on. And it's clear now that the German Navy, which is the ones responsible for the UNIFIL, tracking in the waters of Lebanon, have been involved in this kidnapping of the Lebanese captain, because number one, we saw the German Navy try to shoot down Hezbollah drones in the south of Lebanon, while letting Israeli Air Force pass and infiltrate Lebanon without stopping them. And this German destroyer was just across the beach from Tripoli and Batroun when this incident happened. And it's impossible that these Israeli special forces would go back within a dinghy all the way from the north of Lebanon to the north of Palestine. So we have now direct involvement of the German quote-unquote UNIFIL Navy force in the attack on Lebanon and the violations of Lebanese sovereignty and the kidnapping of Lebanese civilians. Obviously, this also exposed the problems within the Lebanese military, who are also have boats patrolling that specific area, because from that area, there's a lot of illegal, undocumented migration by sea of Palestinian, Syrian refugees and Lebanese people that are looking for livelihood in Europe. And the Lebanese Navy is constantly stopping small boats and searching them, or returning anybody that's trying to cross to Cyprus or Greece. So to see those two things, it shows us that, number one, the Lebanese military is infiltrated. Its leadership is collaborating with the occupation attempts of and the attacks on Lebanon. And this reasserts to us why there is a Hezbollah, because the Lebanese military is infiltrated and or incapable of doing anything to defend this country.
Thank you for that, Laith. So, of course, it's difficult to get information from Western media about what Hezbollah and other resistance factions are doing. But it was reported on October 31st that at least 8 Israelis were killed by Hezbollah rocket attacks, which targeted the northern occupied Palestinian settlements of Metula and the Crayon area near Haifa. Laith, what are you hearing about these Hezbollah attacks? And what else should our audience know about Hezbollah's resistance to Israel's genocidal campaign from this past week?
Yeah, I mean, Hezbollah has been doing amazing, targeting the Kriot area that you mentioned, the industrial zone outside Haifa. This has been bombarded on a daily basis. This is where much of the military industries, factories in the Zionist colony are located. So clearly it is affecting now the ability of the Zionists to manufacture weapons to continue this war. This is also now, the targeting of these military industrial zones is now also reaching other areas, not only around the Kriot in Haifa, but the zone, the industrial zone around Tel Aviv. Yesterday was hit. There was a major weapons manufacturer that the factories were destroyed yesterday. As we see, the mayor of Haifa made a statement earlier this morning saying that actually the city is starting to become empty, that at least half of the residents of Haifa left. And this is, unprecedented, obviously, in the Palestinian struggle, that Haifa is practically liberated now. My mother's family are from Haifa, and I'm now very hopeful that I can go back to my grandparents' house in Haifa if this continues this way. And so smaller colonies that are closer to the border, like Metula, are totally destroyed. There's no more, not one colonialist structure still standing in Kiryat Shmona and Metula and others, especially those colonies that are in the Hula Valley, like Metula and Kiryat Shmona. They're wiped off the map. And this is Hezbollah's retaliation for how the Israelis are deliberately destroying all the structures in the villages in the south of Lebanon. And so we should expect this to continue. And it's making it easier once Hezbollah has destroyed these structures in these colonies. It's becoming harder and harder for the Zionist forces to hide anywhere. So the Hezbollah is targeting them anytime they move in between the colonies in the wooded areas. It's targeting them anytime they come out of the wooded areas to try to invade. They're hitting all their supply lines, all their gathering points. Because of Hezbollah's ability to monitor with its advanced drones any of these movements, as we see, it's really hard for five divisions to do anything. They are being faced with resistance that they've never seen before. And I think Hezbollah is, once now they're practically done with destroying all the frontline colonies, they're starting to move to the second line colonies. And as we see, concentrating more and more on Haifa, there's even residential buildings that are being hit in Haifa, not only the Kriot and the industrial zone. So this is a tit for tat. If the Zionists think that they can empty Tyre or Sur of its residents, well, Haifa should be also emptied of colonists. If the frontline villages in Lebanon are destroyed, well, then all the frontline colonies should be also destroyed. This is above and beyond the constant targeting of Israeli airfields. Hezbollah has been hitting airfields, especially in the north of Palestine, and that's making it, harder for the Israelis to use those airfields. They're now having to take off from south of Palestine to hit south of Lebanon, which, gives time for the resistance to monitor the movement of these aircraft and their intended targets.
Thank you for that, Laith. Something related that we are also very much looking forward to getting your analysis on is the appointment of Naim Qassem as the new Secretary General of Hezbollah. On October 29th, Hezbollah made the announcement that Qassem would replace Hassan Nasrallah, who was assassinated by Israel in late September. Laith, what was your reaction to the appointment of Naim Qassem, and what should our audience know about him, and how do you see this impacting Hezbollah as the war continues to escalate?
Yeah, Naim Qassem is one of the old guard that were there at the founding moments of Hezbollah. He is a good friend of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. And so clearly we can see that there's going to be a continuity in the policies and direction of Hezbollah. The other thing that we should note about the announcement is that it took, around a month for the announcement to, become official, his appointment. And for them to have announced it now, that means that all of Hezbollah's structures have been, fixed up, after all those assassinations. In fact, during the speech of Sayyid Qassem, he said that after that wave of assassinations where Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and much of the leadership of the military wing of Hezbollah were martyred, it took 11 days exactly for Hezbollah to fill all the gaps within its structures. And he also said that every person has a deputy and a deputy to deputy, and they also have a shadow. So, Hezbollah will never have a vacuum within its structures. And he also mentioned how even during those 11 days where Hezbollah was trying to, you know, appoint people to positions, the units on the ground were continuing their work and were kind of independent of the decision-making, central decision-making. And that's something that Hezbollah has already structured its activities like this for a while. The frontline units have a separate command and control than the central command. That is to make sure that it's in a situation of a war that, you know, people don't have to wait to get back to Beirut decisions to, you know, conduct their activities. I would say the last thing about Qasem is that he spent much more time within the military wing of Hezbollah than any other leader. So this means this, you know, this man is going to prioritize the military activities over the political side of things. And in his speech, it was clear that this is what he's going to do. He said, there's no time for talking now. There will be no negotiations, basically. Hezbollah will not be wasting its time on this, and will be concentrating on its objective to defeat the Zionist colony. And he said the head of Amal party is the one that's going to be responsible for negotiations, but he knows the limits of what's the you know, this is Nabih Birri. He's also the spokes the head of the parliament. So they have already given him what is acceptable for Hezbollah to cease fire, and that is an end of the genocide in Gaza, period. Anything less than that, there's nothing to negotiate on, and Hezbollah is working under these presumptions that there will be no stopping of the genocide in Gaza except through the defeat of Israel, and they will be defeating the Zionist colony. And as we see on the ground, it's clear that the Zionist military is defeated.
Thank you, Laith. So, of course, the Western media lets us know that the Israeli occupation army continues to pound Palestine with bombs and other weapons of war, targeting not just civilians, but hospitals, schools, refugee camps, and other sites that are considered war crimes and crimes against humanity under so-called international law. However, we're not hearing much about the Palestinian resistance in the Western media. What should we know? What should we and our audience know about the resistance to Israeli genocide and occupation from this past week?
Yeah, I mean, every day the resistance conducts very important operations. Yesterday, you know, in Jabalia, which has been under blockade for over a month now, and is bombarded relentlessly, and where the hospital of Kamal Adwan Hospital was, you know, all the doctors and nurses were dragged into a pit naked, and I don't know what happened to them. So even in this location in Jabalia, the Israelis are losing badly. This morning they announced 5 Israeli soldiers dead in Jabalia. And of course, in Jabalia is where they lost their highest ranking officer a few weeks ago. And they're still continuing to lose on a daily basis 4 or 5 soldiers, many tanks. And we can watch those videos of Hamas and other groups that are being released even from Jabalia. So what we can see from this is that not only is the most bombarded, besieged location in Gaza still is resisting, and the Israelis unable to hold it, but also that the Palestinian resistance there it still has full, you know, structures that are not only conducting these operations but are producing these videos that we're seeing. So this means that it's in full health, the resistance in Jabalia. Of course, the population in Jabalia is living hell because of how the Zionists are punishing them for their inability of to defeat the resistance in the area. Similarly, yesterday or early this morning, I believe, the resistance fired missiles from North Gaza onto Zionist colonies in the quote-unquote envelope of Gaza. So again, this is supposed to be the area that's mostly most bombarded, and we're still seeing missiles coming out from the ground and firing on the Zionist colonies. So the resistance is, you know, still capable of continuing this fight. And if we remember before the martyrdom of Sinwar, he said that the resistance can fight another year and a half, 2 years with its capabilities that it has now. So I think we, given that Sinwar has been truthful till the last moment of his life, I think we can take his word and understand that the resistance hasn't been defeated and will not be defeated anytime soon.
Appreciate that, especially the comment about Sinwar, and keeping in mind here, forces might increase as well. So, Leith, is there anything else regarding the various Palestinian resistance and axis of resistance factions that our audience should be aware of from the last week or so that we haven't yet discussed?
Yeah, I mean, the Iraqi resistance is firing every day drones and missiles. I mean, every day they're releasing at least 8 videos of operations. You know, I just posted a few hours ago a video of them firing drones on the Dimona nuclear reactor. So the resistance in Iraq has quadrupled its operations over the last month. And similarly, you know, the resistance in Yemen is continuing to target Western shipping trying to go to the Zionist colony. And I think there was one incident that Yemen was mentioned in, although it wasn't involved in it. Yesterday, there was videos filmed by Egyptian civilians that are at the park beside the Suez Canal, and there was an Israeli destroyer, a Sa'ir destroyer, passing through the canal, flying the Egyptian and Israeli flag. And you could hear the Egyptian citizens freaking out. And they're having an argument with an Egyptian officer standing beside them, telling them, shame on you and the military for allowing this. So within minutes, of course, the internet exploded in the Arabic world, because everybody remembers that Jamal Abdel Nasser, the vanquisher, nationalized the Suez Canal and fought the British, the French, and the Israelis in their tripod invasion and defeated them to make sure that the Suez Canal is sovereign and can bring the nation of Egypt wealth from this resource, and they should, you know, be able to control who can come in and out of this canal. And the response from the Suez Canal Corporation was to say that they will not be blockading anybody, that they abide by the 1880 somewhat Constantinople treaty. So there is no more Constantinople, of course. There's an Istanbul right now. And this treaty hasn't been in effect for centuries. And finally, the Egyptians had no problem blockading Qatari shipping when Saudis and Qataris were having a feud and breaching the Constantinople, quote-unquote, the treaty. They also probably will not allow Iranian ships, warships, to go through the Suez Canal to go to Syria to defend Syria, for instance. We know that. So they were shamed, the Egyptian Suez company and the Egyptian military got humiliated and humiliated themselves by allowing such a thing to happen. And people were comparing how Yemen has been, you know, projecting its sovereignty over the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, while Egypt cannot, you know, stop an Israeli ship from passing through the Suez Canal. And then that started all the Egyptian trolls and you know, farms that the Zionists and the Saudis pay for, troll farms, attacking Yemen, although Yemeni government didn't say anything, didn't mention it, didn't talk about it. They started because people were mentioning the glory of Yemen when discussing the humiliation of the Egyptian military and government. They started attacking Yemen by themselves, the Egyptians, which actually backfired on them because the Yemenis were like, hey, we didn't say anything. Why are you bringing us into this? I think, you know, this incident, just watching this video, you know, while it's really ugly, this image of the Israeli ship passing through the canal, it was actually, you know, invigorating to see the Egyptian people losing their mind, being angry, and almost having a physical confrontation with the Egyptian military there. These are just regular tourists coming to the park, and they were shocked. And most of those people that you can see in the video are women. And they were ready to take on the Egyptian soldier. I pity the Egyptian people. This is a proud nation that led Arabic liberation after the colonial era. This is a nation that has tens of thousands of years of history, that was one of the, you know, pillars of civilization in the old age, is now, you know, has been brought down to such a position that it cannot stop a ship from passing through the Suez Canal. I think Egypt is getting ready, probably, for a new free officers revolt. We hope that a new Nasser could be born within the Egyptian army.
Thank you for that. We also wanted to ask you about the news from October 31st that Barclays, one of the UK's largest banks, has divested from the Israeli arms contractor, Elbit Systems. Barclays reportedly sold its entire holdings of 16,345 shares in Elbit, valued at over $3.4 million. Barclays' divestment follows a year-long campaign of direct actions by pro-Palestinian protesters, including Palestine Action, who apparently conducted at least 54 direct actions against Barclays. Laith, what's your reaction to this news? And what, if any, message does it send to activists in the West?
It's great news. And, you know, this is to the credit of Palestine Action, who have exacted a price on Barclays. And there's a lot of banks in the West that are invested in Israeli weapons and Israel in general. and they should be made to pay a price. And clearly, if we're talking about 54 operations by Palestine Action, and let's call them operations, because it is militant, it is revolutionary what they were doing. This is not protesting in the street with a sign. This is actually taking action. And so 54 actions against Barclays, you could clearly, you know, most probably say they probably lost $5 million there just from closing their stores, their banks, and or having to have all the extra security and all of those. So, the price needs to be higher than the profit that they make from investing in Israeli weapons and economy. And not only equal, but double at least. Because these banks, these corporations, these retirement funds in the West that are investing in Israeli weapons and Israeli companies, they do that as a symbol to their masters, not because they're going to really make any profit from Elbit or others. They do that as to show their masters, hey, I've invested in Israel. Open the door for me here. And so they count it as lost money. Okay. So what we need to do is not just make them lose that 3.4 million that they were investing. We need to make them lose $6 million, $10 million in their insistence in continuing to invest. At that point, it becomes illogical for them, even as capitalist, genocidal capitalists that are corrupt and use these investments to open doors in politics and so on, that it's not worth it, because it's not anymore about that $3 million write-off that Barclays had over Elbit. Now it's the $10 million that they had to spend to fight off Palestine Action. This is not even mentioning the lawyers that they had to hire, and there's no lawyer that's going to be hired by Berkeley that takes less than $500 an hour. This is the way to go forward, and anyone that wants to have absolve themselves in the West of guilt from the genocide that's been committed in their name in Palestine must follow suit with Palestine Action. And these people are so brave. I mean, there's at least, I think, 11 of them that are currently political prisoners in British jails. Many of them with no ability to have bail and are going to be held to the court. I think these are the people that are, that are showing us the way in the West for new resistance. Of course, this is the lowest possible way we can resist effectively and not symbolically. And there's the sky is the limit to things that we can learn from other generations of revolutionary actions in the West. And I would say I think yesterday or today was the commemoration of the jailbreak of Assata Shakur, when the Black Liberation Movement broke into the jail where Assata Shakur was being held and liberated her and took her to Cuba. And so we should even think about those things. How can we liberate our political prisoners? People in the UK should be thinking about those things. How can direct action lead to the liberation of our political prisoners, the Palestine Action actionists that have given so much of their liberty to end the genocide in Gaza?
Thank you for that, Laith, and definitely all power and all love and respect to those acting with Palestine Action and others across the world. So similarly, a topic that we have discussed in the past is the political economy of this war. It was reported this past week that U.S. restaurant chains have seen profits collapse as boycotts against Israel's genocidal campaign against Palestine continues. On the 31st of October, it was reported that the parent company of U.S. food outlets such as KFC and Pizza Hut saw an almost 50% fall in profits in the last quarter. American Restaurants, West Asia's largest fast food operator, reported a 48.2% decline in profits as consumers boycott U.S. and Israel-linked brands. Laith, what is your reaction to this news, and what is the broader ongoing analysis of the political economy of this war?
It's amazing. It's amazing. Look, a big part of American projection of power was dependent on the soft power of the allure of America, right? And the American dream and Hollywood and so forth. I remember in 1994, I think it was 93, I was living in Jordan and the first McDonald's opened then in Amman, the capital. And there was crazy lineups, people all rushing to go and eat this garbage. And why? It's because they had this, you know, all the propaganda of the West and the movies and, you know, ads and all of that, that made them feel that, oh, maybe this is something special. Of course, a burger from McDonald's is horrendous in comparison to any corner diner's burger and fries taste better than McDonald's and are cheaper. With time, that allure has gone. And now you have a new generation that are watched as these corporations were feeding the Israeli soldiers openly and bragging about it. So this new generation that all these fast food chains depend on the younger generations being hooked in them, who have already, lost any enthusiasm to all these Western corporate food chains, have now had an extra emphasis on why they shouldn't go by seeing this. And so if the kids don't want to go to McDonald's, the kids that are on TikTok that everybody was blaming for being so unengaged, the parents are not going to go to McDonald's, okay? And so it is amazing to see how this mass boycott by individuals without being prompted, without being forced to, is leading to this. And I think these numbers are going to only increase the number of collapse of sales for these corporations. And it's beyond the Arabic or Muslim world. Look at Vietnam, look at China, look at even in countries like Japan, there is a decrease in sales for all those corporations. People are sick of it, number one. And also, look at what happened in Russia after the U.S. pulled all those chains out. It just got flipped to a Russian chain and is now selling more than the same McDonald's was selling in Russia. And that's the future. Nobody thinks that there's anything special left in that America can offer. The allure of Americana is dying. There's no more Elvis Presley's. We have Cardi B instead of Elvis Presley. I mean, it's not that I'm a big fan of Elvis, but you could understand the allure of what is Americana in the 1950s and 60s to what is Americana now. And Americana now is the opposite, at least in the minds of the world, of what it was after World War II.
Thank you for that analysis. Excuse me. Leith, our final question is in regards to the U.S. presidential election, which is right around the corner. Of course, the election features a convicted felon against someone committing war crimes in real time. Leith, what's your analysis of the election, and how do you see the outcome impacting this rapidly escalating war in West Asia?
It has been a really strange thing to be sitting outside and watching the American public, beat each other over who's going to be the next emperor. My wife and kids are American citizens, and I don't think they'll ever vote. I've personally never voted in any election, neither in Canada or anywhere else. I don't think voting is real, number one. Okay, it will be a condemnation of the American people and American civilization if we actually believe that Kamala Harris and Trump represent the free will of the American people. America can birth a million people better than these two. So it's a clear indication that there is no such thing as democracy in the U.S. And I was looking over the last few days at the attacks on the Arabic and Muslim community that are refusing to vote for Kamala Harris, the racist attacks, and or the racist attacks against black men that were refusing to also vote for Kamala Harris. I was thinking to myself, do you think these attacks, these racist tirades, will actually convince anybody to vote for you or actually engage? But the overall, the looking at the election, I felt even those who are trying to vote for Jill Stein, the Greens, and or
Dr. West,
exactly, Dr. West. I thought to myself, do you really actually believe that is possible? Number one, they're not going. Even if there was. Those votes actually counted. Are they going to get it? No. So why are you wasting your time on something that is impossible, not only about the election of West or Jill Stein, but actually democracy in general? So, those who are going to waste the next 2 days trying to get people out to vote, for what? You should be beginning to organize for rebellion. The United States is currently engaged in genocide, financing genocide, weaponizing genocide, and wants to expand this genocidal killing field from Gaza to the whole region. What is your vote that doesn't count anyways gonna do? Why aren't people beginning to organize, to take action, like Pakistan action? Why aren't people starting to organize? The United States is a country where anyone can buy a weapon and carry a weapon. You're not in Canada where it's illegal to purchase weapons. You have the right to. You have the right to walk with weapons and defend your community. You have the right to have a militia under the Constitution of the United States. Where is the groups like the Black Panthers of the 1960s and 70s This is the time for that. It is time for the Arabic, Muslim, and Black communities to rearm themselves and to openly announce militias to defend themselves. It is time for that to happen. Anything less than that is not going to make any difference. Not any difference, zero difference. As long as people in the US are okay with going out in the street and getting beaten up and have the sidewalk wiped with their face and then thrown in jail and then go cycle again and again, why would the US stop from beating you, the police beating you, or the military stopping bombing our region here, or the politicians listen to you? You are a doormat. All the US citizens currently are doormats. The only ones that are not doormats are those few young men and women that are in jail right now for doing a Palestine action kind of activity in, I think it's Massachusetts or some one of those states where they destroyed an Israeli weapons manufacturer. The rest of the US citizens account to zero to the decisions. So we will see. I personally don't care who wins the election. It's not going to make a difference. The US is an empire that has been stable for a couple of hundred years, that has never had an invasion on its territory, that has been drawing 100-year plans, not only 7-year plans or 30-year plans or 50 years, 100-year plans. And those 100-year plans are set in stone, and it doesn't matter who the president is and who gets elected. They have only a margin of choosing tactical maneuvers to continue on this 100-year plan. And maybe the U.S. public will awaken after Tuesday once they see the results of the election. And I personally think that the establishment will choose Trump to be the next president. And it makes sense, because the only reason you have this Democrat-Republican theatrical democracy is that the U.S. Plays out its liberal imperialism for a period. And once, and when that doesn't work, they bring in their monster face. You know, you go from George Bush to Obama to Trump to Biden to Trump. So when the liberal imperialist strategy doesn't work, they bring the monster face like Trump. And that's the elite that are putting them in power. Don't mind all the media brouhaha that, you know, somehow there is a fight or something between the elite. That's all for theatrics.
Appreciate that very much, Laith. Is there anything else that we can cover today? These are all the questions we have. Was there any last words you wanted to share or any thoughts before we sign off here?
No, thank you very much for having me. Visit freepalestine.video, donate. We're launching coverage from Jordan very shortly, so more content from areas that have not been given much attention in the media. So please donate freepalestine.video.
Thank you so much. Looking forward to speaking.
We state these facts only to let you know that those of us who are revolutionary, Pan-Africanists, is not because we love revolution. It is historically determined, and we have no alternative but to follow history and to use history for the benefit of our people.